the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. Hi, this is John Barber. That was Sarita singing Sunny and Frank Sinatra saying, Here's Johnny. The night he hosted The Tonight Show. Tonight, I am not in Las Vegas, but in Washington, D.C. The D.C. standing for decidedly cold. I mean, it is freezing here. How cold is it, John? It's so cold. In an emergency, if you call 911, they tell you to call back in the spring. It's so cold. Hitchhikers are holding up pictures of thumbs. And Santa has snowballs. I am here, as most of you know, because with the flurry of CIA JFK files released these past few weeks, we decided to come here and invite members of Congress to one of our free screenings of the American media and the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Surprisingly, we have received three positive responses. The first screening is that at American University, where John Kennedy in 1963 gave his most famous peace speech. This screening is Wednesday between 5:30 and 7:30 p.m. The second is at Mott House on November 22nd, the 54th anniversary of President Kennedy's murder. This screening and Q&A is from 2 to 5 p.m. And on Thursday evening, I will speaking to the revered McClendon Group at the Press Club. Right now, though, I am speaking to one of the most interesting guests we have ever had on this show with our largest listening audience. His startling story about the CIA admitting to training Lee Harvey Oswald is all over the front pages of the National Enquirer, sold out. He is the last surviving Jim Garrison investigator and one of Mr. Garrison's most important. And aside from being one of Hollywood's leading media consultants, he is one of the leaders in producing films about the assassination, beginning with Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment documentary and the movie Executive Action, and out soon with another book and show, another film to follow Rush to Judgment. He made major contributions to our first film, The Garrison Tapes, and again to part two, The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. You can see why we rushed to rebook him to many, many future shows. A grateful welcome to Jim Garrison's and Mark Lane's and mine and yours and the friend of truth, Steve Jaffe. Steve, thank you so much and welcome to the show. Steve?
I'm really excited that you're there in Washington and you have the attention of the press corps and possibly members of Congress so you can explain to them what happened in November of 1963 because maybe they didn't read about it.
Well, listen, the attention that we're probably getting for the film may in large part be your responsibility because of that unbelievable cover story in the National Enquirer. I never, Steve, thought in my life I would compliment anybody for getting a headline story in the National Enquirer. So I have to ask you, with that great story and that great information, did you first offer it to, let's say, the Washington Post, to the New York Times, or anybody else?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it was like walking in your shoes in terms of the documentary that you made about how the media turned its back on the assassination of President Kennedy and the truth regarding who killed him And why? The fact is that when I realized that the document release was scheduled for October 26th this year, that was a law that was passed in 1992, and President Trump had said that he would not block it for any reason, I began to look through my files because I'm in the process of writing a book, actually a couple of books. One is forensically oriented and the other's about my experiences. And I found documents which I thought would finally be released by the CIA and the FBI and anything else that was in the archives that had been held. And then the more I began to experience what I'm about to tell you, the more I began to doubt what might be released from the National Archives. And despite the law, sure enough, the FBI and the CIA made their appeals to the president, and the White House agreed to withhold even 300 files out of some 3,100 files, which are held back even as we speak. However, there are documents which I've had in my possession and in my files for decades, and it was, you know, I was hoping that they would come out officially, but it doesn't mean that I can't release them myself, or at least so I said to myself. In any event, I called the Associated Press, I called the Washington Post, I called NBC and MSNBC, I called the New York Times, I called the LA Times. And everybody was so interested, they couldn't wait to find out that I had a document which, in fact, was dated back in March 3rd, 1964, from the director of the Central Intelligence, John McCone, directed to the chief of Secret Service. And very, very pointedly, in that document, he admitted that Oswald's subject was trained by this agency. So, I mean, there's no doubt about that. This is an official document. It's easily authenticated. And yet the more I talked to the press, or should I say I talked to the press, the less I got in terms of their response. Even the guy who wrote a story about the documents being released and for USA Today, he was eager to get what I had, and then all of a sudden, silence. So when the National Enquirer had offered me as much space as I needed to tell the story, and we're talking about 4 pages plus the cover.
Amazing.
I thought, okay, you know, it's important that people know about this, so I let them have it.
Well, I must tell you, it is absolutely breathtaking. It's startling. And I was stunned to find out that was one of the documents that was not released, but that you had had in your possession all of that time and had never talked about it until you contacted and did the story for the National Enquirer. What kind of feedback did you get? Did you get any negative? Let's say you talked to somebody at the LA Times. Did you ever get any negative feedback from them saying, why on earth did you do that to give that to the National Enquirer?
No, I didn't. I didn't get any feedback at all. In fact, it was radio silence. The only people that I spoke with from, say, the Associated Press who responded to me in a positive way were people who you might say had nothing, no stake in the, no skin in the game. They were involved in covering different areas of show business and other areas of the news. They thought this was earth-shattering news. It is earth-shattering news, and they didn't really understand why it would even be considered as something that wouldn't be released by the government. But when it came to following up with any of the people, as I mentioned, I got no answer at all. Nobody talked to me about whether or not it was a positive or a negative, to put it. They just would not talk to me. And I was shocked, but I was delighted that dealing with the National Enquirer was like dealing with a real newspaper. They asked me questions about authenticity. They were very tough on me about making sure that this was a real document. And I had to go through a vetting process. And then they were totally supportive, and they thought this deserved, it was a cover story for them. And it sold right off the stands. I mean, it was, I couldn't even get them myself.
Well, as I said to you, when my wife saw it, and I said, well, it's on the phone. I'll give it to you. You can have it. She says, no, you go to the market and get it. And I got the last six copies, and they were gone. And people were asking me about it as I walked out. And I said, listen, this is an earth-shattering story, and sadly, it's only in this paper. What kind of reaction did you get from the article, though? Because it certainly was sold out, and it must have been read by millions of people.
It was, and the paper got tremendous reaction, just from people who know me or know about me or who Googled me, because I have a public relations business, and I have worked in the past in the entertainment industry. And then I began to work and do crisis management and litigation support public relations, which is a different area. But either way, it's easy to Google my name and to find who I am and how to get in touch with me. So I got tremendous reaction from the community, which is growing smaller because we're all getting older, of researchers who are aware of the facts about the assassination of President Kennedy. I got a really positive response from them. I also, interestingly enough, was invited to speak to a group of men who are CEOs or retired CEOs of a number of major media companies, and all of them, the other part of the group are attorneys. And I got a tremendous reaction because I sat there for an hour and a half and said, I will answer any and every question that you have until you have no more questions, because this is not a time to hold back. This is a time for us to clear the decks and to get the entire truth out, to name the names and talk about people who were responsible for this coup d'etat in America. And so the reaction has been great. The only reaction I got silence from was the media itself, and it's astonishing.
You mean you have already spoken to this group of media CEOs? It's not something
media, I mean these are the former heads of studios, heads of networks, a lot of top people, not the news media, because those people are basically difficult for me to reach. On the other hand, I haven't published my book. I actually have two books. I haven't published them yet. I would expect that with the addition, I got a call from somebody who wanted to book me at college campuses to speak, you know, at colleges, and they said the audiences are fantastic there. And I'm looking forward to doing that. But right now I've got these books to finish, and I've got to finish the last touches on a film that Mark Lane and I did called A Rush to Judgment, to follow up on the film he did in 1966 called Rush to Judgment after his book, in which there are interviews with people who are material witnesses to the case. And now we have followed that up with interviews that have almost replaced the interviews from the previous film, because so many people are available to be interviewed or were during the course of the last decades, and some of them, most of them actually have passed away.
Well, in the meetings with you had with these former CEOs of media companies, I'm sure one of them must have had a comment about how he felt about maybe not reporting the story when he was in a position to. But to you, what was the most interesting or startling question that one of them might have asked you?
I don't think I was startled by any of the questions, because over the years, in just talking with family and friends and close acquaintances, I've pretty much entertained every possible question you can imagine, as have you. One of the most interesting questions has always been, why did not the Kennedy family, why did not Bobby Kennedy, who was Attorney General, do anything about it? Why don't they agree with you? And or over the years, have they agreed with you? Have they ever, you know, said that the case needed to be reopened? And, you know, so that's an interesting area. It's a very, you know, important and obvious question to be asked. And how would you answer?
How would you answer a question like that? Because I've had a number of people say to me, they look at the film and they see the portion about Walter Sheraton, who was, of course, a friend of the CIA and the FBI, and he's sent down there deliberately to sabotage Jim Garrison by getting his prime witness, Perry Raymond Russo, to move to California and go to work for an insurance company for $50,000. And Garrison wires him. And, of course, they record Sheraton with the bribe, and charges are brought against NBC, which never reach a court. But as you saw in the film and as you saw in real time, he was given time late night on NBC to present his case. And it was just absolutely startling. But when people see that, they say to me, those who were informed say, but wasn't Walter Sheraton also an aide to Robert Kennedy? And as an aide to Robert Kennedy, why would he try to sabotage Garrison and not help a person to whom he was supposed to be an aide, which was Bobby? And I am sort of at a loss for an answer for that. How would you answer that?
Well, I'll tell you, it's complicated, but it makes sense, and I'll give you the answer. And the fact is that the people who plotted the crime, the people that plotted the murder, found that was not so difficult. In other words, the CIA was involved in overthrowing governments in past history prior to the assassination of President Kennedy. The CIA had used, for crimes of assassination, they had used members of the mob or figures in the mob to assist them in doing crimes like that. And they also had at their disposal highly trained anti-Castro soldiers who were trained by the likes of Gerald Patrick Hemming, who is discussed extensively in the new documents which are released, and people like, so that was one element of it. But the cover-up was planned in an ingenious way, and they had to know that one of their biggest problems was to neutralize Bobby Kennedy, who was not just his brother. He was the Attorney General and could supervise the Justice Department and, under that, the FBI. Well, obviously, he couldn't supervise J. Edgar Hoover, because J. Edgar Hoover viewed the Kennedy brothers as people, as they say, passing through his administration. In fact, Hoover, I guess it's known, is often signed his initials to the various different FBI documents, but occasionally you see high-level documents signed by Hoover with the initials S-O-G, which meant seat of government.
And that's goodness gracious.
But anyway, Hoover, the CIA people like James Angleton and Richard Helms, who were involved in covering up the assassination, those people knew they had to have something that would stop Bobby Kennedy and Ted Kennedy, who was a United States senator. They had to stop them from meddling in the investigation. And later, Garrison came about, but that was years later. So what happened was they made sure that among the people who were recruited for the actual assassination of the president were anti-Castro Cubans, because remember, there were several teams of assassins who were in place in Dallas and Dealey Plaza, so that there was no chance that he would escape the plaza without being fatally wounded. They had used some of the operatives from the CIA operatives from the very plots to kill Castro that the CIA had, you know, been doing under Eisenhower, and that JFK reluctantly inherited and then approved to go ahead and overthrow Castro. They used some of those people, and when the leaves of the or the skin of the onion began to be peeled back to reveal what was underneath it, it was became obvious that some of the same people plotting under Bobby Kennedy's supervision to kill Castro were involved in the plot that ended up killing his brother. And that was something that he wanted to keep the lid on before it reflected on him personally and before he could find out what the facts were, because they had to keep him in as much of the dark as they did the president.
That's
part of it, and that's why I say it's complicated.
Well, it's complicated, but it is also ingenious. And I guess that's the reason, as you well know, when Mort Saul was amongst one of Jim's investigators, and Jim knew that Mort had a close association with the Kennedys, and he had said to Mort, "You better tell Bobby to go public. Otherwise, that if you tell him to go public and he does, it'll save his life." And I guess Mort was unsuccessful in that regard. And I guess Bobby Kennedy was stunned into silence because he didn't, as you just say, he didn't want it revealed that some of the people that he had tried to recruit to kill Castro ended up being part of the team that ended up killing his brother. Well, with all of this, I mean, I wish I could be in a university or college setting when you come to speak. So the first time you get one of these speaking gigs, you must call me, because no matter where you are in the country, I want to come and sit in that audience and listen to you, watch the students' reaction and listen to their questions, because you are an unbelievable storyteller, as we've already seen in the way you produce Rush to Judgment and Executive Action. Now, with what has happened with the flood of sales of your story in the National Enquirer, showing that people are still intensely interested in that case, what do you think is going to happen, if anything?
Well, on the side of the investigation, I don't hold out much hope, because after 54 years and having seen the best of the investigators thwarted, and that being Jim Garrison, I don't hold out much hope for law enforcement per se, or for our government per se, to investigate what appears to be very well documented as a crime, as a coup d'etat. And yet I do see that the people are no less hungry today than they were then for the information and the truth about our history and about what happened to our country. And so the way this thing flew off the stands, the first thing I got was a call from the editors of the National Enquirer saying, "Can you write another story? And can you got any more information?" And I said, "Yeah, I got tons of information. I just hadn't planned to come in from the cold. And I was going to live my life relatively obscurely. And that just doesn't seem to be in the cards. I owe it to Garrison and to my friend Mark Lane to continue on with this fight, and I think that's the way it has to be. So we've got this film. The Enquirer had me write another story immediately, which I think comes out next Friday, about another document, another amazing document, which is, it's not like it's the first time anybody's ever heard of it, because it's in your film. But anyway, it helps to support each other in every possible forum. And so you will see a document and the story coming out in the next issue of the National Enquirer, because if that is the way it is, and that's where I can, the only place I can publish my work, then that's where I'll publish it, and it will be pristine. It will be I welcome any challenge. I welcome any challenge indeed, but I will not stop writing. And so, and sure enough, there have been interest from publishing companies, and a lot of people are interested in publishing the book. So I think that we're going to see more information. But I and you know, let me add one thing. I think it's just enormously ironic, and so well it should be, that the National Enquirer becomes one of the first places where I was given enough space and enough attention and the appropriate amount of attention to tell the story. The other thing that I find is equally ironic is that instead of the mainstream media, you go to the absolute opposite end of the aisle and you tell your stories. However, I think that your film is a critical, critical element. I think your film is the quintessential film. There is no better film. There can only be additional films. And that is what the best I can say of the documentary that Mark Lane and I did. We're just adding to the story that you have already adequately and superbly summarized. So I don't want you to be in the audience. I want you to be on the stage. And wherever you screen the movie, I want to be there. And wherever I talk, I want you to be there too.
What is so startling, Steve, is that the very first time I screened this film, which is at the Texas Theater a year ago, November 22nd, and that was the rough cut. Oh, it was about 90% done. 300 people in the audience. 270 of them had never been born when John Kennedy was murdered, and the film got a spontaneous standing ovation. So, you know, there's something out there. I don't know what it is, and I don't know how to describe it, and if I do, it almost sounds metaphysical or spiritual, but somehow or another, there's something that tells people there was once a Camelot. There was once a John Kennedy. There once was a peace president, and we want that time back. And for me, I have very, very mixed feelings. It is costing me a lot of money to come here and do these free screenings. Now, between you and me, I guess it started in 1970. I was unable to get Jim on my morning show, but in 1981, I did the interview with him and then made the documentary, which you made enormous contributions to, and then part two. I said, probably I have spent over $400,000 that I'll never see again. Now, I was lucky enough that I made a great deal of money so that I had it to spend. But, you know, it sounds like it reminds me of Red Fox was my mentor when I started as a comic. And he had one great line. He said, John, heroes ain't born. They're cornered. Well, you were cornered. You were cornered, as was Jim Garrison when he accidentally bumped into Hale Boggs, who said, hey, that kid could have never fired that old gun. I'm a hunter. He couldn't have done it. And Hale Boggs was a dissenting member of the Warren Commission who was never published, and this guy disappears later on. And You're the same way. I mean, you donated your time and talents for no money whatsoever. And you put yourself at risk, and also you probably maybe had strained a little bit the wonderful relationship you had with your father, who was a very prominent doctor. So, And you're not getting anything out of that. But my feeling is, I say, and I feel that this is the last hurrah. Now, there are, I don't know how many will attend at American University or how many will attend at Mott House, but let's say there are only 100 or 120 in that standing room only. That's wonderful that these people will see it. What is most important, I had to spend a great deal of money to get somebody like you on the East Coast, who was a top PR person, to put out a press release. That press release went out, which I forwarded to you, which will go to the eyes of tens of thousands of people, which means they will know that the movie exists and they can see it for the cheapest price possible, which is $2. So I'm never going to get back the money. But that's why I did it. I feel it's the last hurrah. And like you, I just finished my autobiography after 5 years, and there's a possibility I may have a publisher after the first of the year. If not, I will self-publish that. And, you know, it is people like you that I run into all of the time. Do you know that half of the people, Steve, half of the people who have gone out of their way to help me spread the truth about my film, I have never even met. There's a fellow named Andrew Craig, who is head of COPI, I guess it's called Citizens Opposed to Political Assassinations. When he heard 2 months ago that I was considering coming to Washington, he called me right away and he said, I will set up screenings for you at Mott House. And I'm startled. And that's what's happening.
It's interesting. What's interesting to me is that the fact that they suppressed the truth is, if in essence, it's like saying they suppressed the story of what really happened. And the story being the overthrow of the U.S. government by murdering the president is a pretty damned interesting story. So what you find now is that there are audiences, whether they be students or readers of books or readers of the damn National Enquirer, they are people who are really thirsty for the truth about this part of our history. And so it was the very people who created the cover-up created the audience for this part of what we're doing right now. And
you're right. You know what it is? It's like the CIA and the media and the government. It is, they tried to lay the concrete over the facts of Jim Garrison solving the case in 1967. However, it's just like little blades of grass that keep popping up in the cracks. The truth of it, and it's blossoming. It really is. And a lot of it comes about because of people like you. What you're going to call the second documentary A Rush to Judgment?
Yeah, well, for legal reasons, we're calling it A Rush to Judgment. And my guess is we're going to subtitle it, because this is something that actually I agreed on with Mark before he passed away. We're going to subtitle it Conspiracy in America. And if you figure out the initials of what that stands
CIA.
For.
CIA. Oh, my
okay.
God.
So we're going to really call it Conspiracy in America, A Rush to Judgment. And basically, it's like Martin Luther King said, the truth crushed to earth shall rise again. He was actually quoting William Bryant, but it's not important who said it. The truth crushed to earth will rise again. And these things that we have done, nobody can ever accuse us for doing it for money. That's what I was worried about in the early days. I didn't want to release the Zapruder film, even though I had to go all the way to Paris and meet with de Gaulle to get the Zapruder film, because when Garrison subpoenaed it from Time Life, they sent him some unexposed leader. I mean, he didn't even have any emulsion on the film when they got the Zapruder film out. And he said to me, well, I had already started to reach out to the French intelligence agencies because we were tipped off that they knew something about it. So anyway, I went there, got a copy of the Zapruder film, which they got to me, and that was what Garrison used and showed it to the jury in the trial. And every member of the jury said there was no question in their mind but that President Kennedy was fatally wounded by a shot from the grassy knoll. And, you know, that's just the forensic level of what's going on here. But, you know, it needs to be told. I don't think that the audience anymore is unreceptive. I think the press is unreceptive. And that's a sad state in America, but I don't want to talk about eliminating the First Amendment, because we desperately need to be able to speak freely. And
I'll tell you something. The First Amendment allows freedom of speech in America as long as you don't have an audience. I think it was Mark Twain said something about the fact that America is the only country that has a freedom of speech and the wisdom not to use it. And we quote Mark Twain a lot in the film. When is your film coming out? After the first of the year?
Well, I'm waiting for three things to happen. There are publishers, and there are ways of self-publishing. There's also Amazon Kindle Books, which electronically can send your book out to everybody in the world. And so
yes.
I'm entertaining those things. And I would guess that in January, February, I'll be able to get at least one of the two books out, and the documentary will follow, if not come at the same time.
Well, after the first of the year, listen, you're going to be on this show many, many times. People absolutely loved you, as do I. So you're going to have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and we can give thanks to people like you. You give my love to your wife, and after the Christmas holidays, I'm going to come down to Los Angeles, and we are going to get together, and you'll be back on the show in January. And again, Steve, I want to thank you very, 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 very much, because none of us could have done any of this without you, without Jim, and without Mark Lane. So you have a great, great Thanksgiving.
Well,
I'm going to take
you.
A break now and come back with somebody who is also a huge admirer of yours, my cohort, Joe Satilli. Thank you so much,
okay.
Steve. We'll be
thank
right
you.
Back.
Bye, John.
Bye-bye.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing?
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you. That smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back to John Barber's World, where John Barber's World is now in Washington, D.C. for the next 9 days for two free screenings of our documentary, and someone else who made an enormous contribution to that film and makes a major contribution to every one of my shows is my brilliant cohort, the creator of one of the best, if not the best, independent news daily newsletters in America. It's called News Vandal. Welcome back, Joe Satilli. Hi, Joe. How are you?
Hi, but I'm actually going to rename it Marbles in a Blender, because that's really what the news cycle has become. I mean, we just had the one-year anniversary of the election, and if you think about it, we're now about, I think, almost, 2.25 years into what seems like a nonstop political campaign, and the pace of the news, the variety of things that happen. I'll be honest with you, I don't know how I get that thing out in the morning with all the stuff that's going on, but it's probably more important than ever to try and make some sense of it. I'm not sure that I do.
Well, you make amazing sense of it, and I am startled constantly by the quality of the articles that you find to reproduce, or even the stuff that you write yourself, which is brilliant. And you know what? I never even thought about it, that this is like the first anniversary of the election, because to me, it seems like it's a continuation of the CNN debates.
I think that's the oddity of it, is that there has, you know, normally there's like a process. You go through a series of steps, and none of those steps have been there. It's just been one giant melange. It's all sort of run together, because it seems like the campaign never really ended. And in many ways it hasn't, because, you know, really this administration is not quite governing. When they do govern, they do things like put this guy, the new HHS secretary is a guy named Alex Azar, who is a former executive at Eli Lilly. So the guy from Eli Lilly is now going to be in charge of healthcare policy for the administration. So, you know, we have so many of those things where industry is just sort of slid over and taken over things, while Donald Trump has performed what is really the greatest show on earth. And now, you may not, I don't say great as, you know, like it's good or bad, but great in terms of its ability to consume everything. And it has been all consuming. And I can tell you, if you're a Steven Mnuchin who wants to give his buddies on Wall Street a tax cut, or you're a big farmer, you want to take care of drug pricing policy, if you're Whitefish, this two-man company that was building power lines in Puerto Rico, they were charging the government over $300 per hour for their services, and they were contracting out to workers for $60 an hour, which is a pretty good markup. You know, if that's what you're into, I mean, this is gravy train. This is perfect time. But I think for all of us on the other side of it, who are not making money off of the Trump administration, we're kind of stuck on a carnival ride that we can't get off.
Well, you know, you mentioned the business about the $300 an hour they're charging the government and the subcontract for $60 an hour. We read that and we are outraged, but we get so depressed with finding out the truth about this thing, because in Congress, there is no sense of outrage as to what corporate America is doing to ordinary citizens. I mean, Puerto Rico is still a mess.
Yeah, yeah, and still mostly in the dark. And here's the strange challenge, and I think that this kind of dovetails dovetails with the new sort of scandal du jour, which is Roy Moore. Roy Moore is the Senate candidate, Republican. In Alabama, he was Steve Bannon's choice in the primary. Luther Strange, who was appointed to fill in for Jeff Sessions when Jeff Sessions became Attorney General, he was Donald Trump's choice. Steve Bannon's choice won. Roy Moore is an interesting guy who thinks that homosexual conduct should be illegal. He doesn't think that the rights and laws of the United States actually come from the Constitution. He thinks they come from God, and that actually God's law, when you are adjudicating court cases like he was in the court system of Alabama, that God's law supersedes the Constitution. So then he famously is the guy who kept putting the Ten Commandments out in front of the courthouse, and it kept being taken down, and then he would be thrown off of the bench. Well, now he's involved in what's turning into kind of a Weinstein effect scandal. Another woman today came out and gave a compelling account. Her name is Beverly Young Nelson, gave a compelling account of what sounds like a sexual assault back when she was a teenager. And now there's a New Yorker story talking about how a new mall in the 70s that was built there in Alabama had to actually ask a Roy Moore to not stick around because he was harassing teenage girls. So things are not going well for Roy Moore, right? So, but this scandal is absorbing the news cycle when, as you were pointing out, there's all this corporate stuff going on, and the people in Congress, what are they doing? Well, they're reacting to either the scandal du jour of Donald Trump, Russiagate, you know, tweeting out stuff about Kim Jong-un being short and fat, Duterte singing to him after he's like shooting people in the street for taking drugs. All of that's going on. The big carnival show's going on. And then these Roy Moore things cases come up. And then what do we do? Do we say, well, we need to ignore the Roy? You can't ignore the Roy Moore thing. You can't ignore the fact that he's tweeting. Donald Trump is tweeting at a guy who's nuclear armed. You can't ignore these things, but at the same time, it does feel like the sideshow is keeping us from getting our heads around the far more pernicious problems of corporate crime, which are so endemic in this administration. I've looked at a lot of administrations over the years, and the Bush administration, Bush 2, you know, what was going on in Afghanistan and Iraq was really amazing. I thought I would never see anything on that level. And in terms of scale, Donald Trump's administration is not at the scale because you don't have pallets of cash being shipped over to Iraq and Afghanistan and being willy-nilly. So you don't have that. But in terms of at every single turn in an administration, I've never seen it where every department was literally turned over. Direct ability to profit, or their buddies had a direct ability to profit from their involvement in that department. I've never seen anything like it.
Well, it's, you know, when you look at that, especially the Roy Moore thing that you're talking about, it seems to me that not only is America not advanced at all intellectually, they may have actually regressed. I watched a movie the other night that I loved as a play years and years ago. I think I saw it in the 50s or the 60s. It was called Inherit the Wind as a play, and as a movie, it's Frederick March and it's Spencer Tracy. And it's a filming of a dramatization of the Scopes Monkey Trial. And you know what? This stuff that's coming out about this guy is actually the same thing. I mean, that God's laws and the Ten Commandments supersede anything that was in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. It's startling that anybody who believes that ever is elected to any kind of office in this country, and they seem to be getting elected more and more and more. For some reason or other, maybe it's insecurity. I have no, and maybe it's emotional insecurity or intellectual insecurity. The people seem to be retreating into belief. People seem to be retreating into Christianity or Judaism or some kind of weird religion just to give their life a purpose or explain their life. It is just getting worse, Joe.
Well, I'll take it even, it's even broader than that. You mentioned Judaism, where you have a sort of radical form of Orthodox Judaism, which has kind of ridden on the coattails of Netanyahu's long tenure there atop the political system. We actually had situations where there were Orthodox Jews in Israel who wanted women to sit in the back of the bus so they would be separate from men. And there has been a long battle over women being able to go to the Wailing Wall in Israel. So you have there's that there. We obviously know about fundamentalist Islam and its impact throughout the Islamic world, being spread primarily initially by the Saudi Arabians and with the little help from the CIA and you know, hand in glove thing for political purposes, but it has taken off. Right now in Myanmar, a country formerly known as Burma, there is radical fundamentalist Buddhism, which has stoked ethnic cleansing of a Muslim minority there, the Rohingya. We have fundamentalist Hinduism rising up in Narendra Modi's, he's the prime minister, Narendra Modi's India, where actually Christians and Muslims are being killed by radical Hindus. And there are actually there are Hindu gangs that are going around, and any Muslim who has slaughtered a cow is in danger of their life. So there is a radical traditionalism or a radical fundamentalism that has taken hold in all of the great religions. It's not just Islam, and it's not just here Christianity in the United States. And one wonders if it's some kind of – we have a sense that we're at a precipice, that we are actually using up the planet's resources faster than the planet can replenish them. We are despoiling the waters. There are 10 rivers that are clogged with plastic, and the plastic is spilling out into the oceans. A lot of the fish that people are eating actually has microscopic plastic in it. And our air is – right now the city of Delhi is so hazardous that people are falling ill from the smog and the pollution that has fallen over it. I mean, we are – in a sense, you wonder if we subconsciously, as a race, as the human race, know that we are defecating where we live, eat, and breathe, and that we are running out of resources, and people are retreating into tribal affiliations, one for their own protection, and another way just to try and, as a coping mechanism for sort of the doomsday scenario that's in the offing.
Well, in this country, fundamentalist Christians seem to be looking forward to the end times with joy.
Yes.
Well, and you used the adjective great when you were describing religions. How can you describe any religion as great? You might describe one as influential, or you might describe one as large. I don't know that I would describe it as great for this reason. It is more proof that people do not reason. People are not reasoning creatures. They are not intellectual creatures. They are emotional creatures. We are groomed emotionally long before we have a mind that we can think with. Look at, you have supposedly one God. Do you know there are actually 4,200 legitimate organized religions in the world? How can you have 4,200 different religions worshiping a supposed one mythical God? It is totally beyond me. But John,
if you are organizing yourself around a tribal affiliation where then greed enters the equation, and it's we got to get what we need for ourselves so that they over there can't get theirs. And so that's why our God is bigger than your God. And our God has determined that we get to have this stuff, and your God is not a real God. And our God doesn't like people who don't have real gods, which is why you shouldn't have this stuff and we should. This is the Puritans. This is the earliest colonists who came to America, who came to Massachusetts Bay Colony and saw these Indians and said, huh, look at you. You're kind of imps of Satan, aren't you? That's what they called them, imps of Satan. And once they became imps of Satan, who were not using the land according to God's wishes, they became easily expendable. And expendable in a way that, oddly enough, did not seem to be in contradiction with their religious beliefs, even though it seems to me, whether it's the Ten Commandments or the book of Matthew in the New Testament, it didn't – I don't read anything in there like, and thou shalt encounter imps of Satan and purge them from the land so that thou shalt grow corn in abundance. I don't read that.
It seems to me that Christians didn't land in Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on the Christians. And then look at Christopher Columbus. He's looking for a route to China.
Yeah.
And he gets lost.
Yeah.
And he ends up in the Caribbean somewhere, and he's rescued by a bunch of natives. And the natives don't know what private property is because they're all communal. Nobody owns property. And what does Christopher Columbus do? He cuts off 1,000 hands to teach them the value of private property. And this is a guy to whom we erect statues and we gave a holiday to. I mean, if you know what? It's like a Peter Sellers Monty Python movie. The whole world is turning into that. Do you know, there are 195 countries in the world. Every country except maybe Switzerland has an army. Every country gives dozens and dozens of medals, hundreds of medals for going to war. So that means that there are 12,500 medals around the world for going to war, but there is only one peace prize.
Right, right.
What kind of world are we living in?
Okay, well, let's try a glass. I'm going to make a stab at it, a glass half full idea. And on, there is a another way of looking at what we're seeing, including Trump, let's make America great again. Let's take our country back. We want to go back. We want it the way it was. There's that in there. What if what we're seeing really is the death rattle of a way of life and a way of thinking, not the beginning of something, but that death rattle that comes at the end when you've got the bad guy or whatever cornered and they have to fight back. Maybe that's what we're seeing. And I'll tell you very quickly, the election of Danica Rome to a state seat in Virginia, a trans woman who beat the guy who put the anti-trans bathroom bill on the ballot in Virginia and said, "I am the state's leading homophobe." He was defeated by a trans woman. I think maybe we're moving towards something and not moving away from something and not towards something.
You know, you describe it as the death rattle. I think you're absolutely and totally right that it is a death rattle. And there doesn't seem to be anybody around. You can't look at any. When I was younger and you were younger, there were so many people that I could respect and admire and look up to, not only in this country, in government, in literature, and in music, but even in television. The reason I got into television is because I loved Ed Murrow, and I loved Jack Parr, and I loved Alastair Cook, and I loved Ernie Kovacs. I saw this genius there. It's all gone. It's absolutely totally gone. Anyway, Joe, I want to thank you so much. Where can people get your news, Vandal? And so tell us where you're appearing next also.
Yeah, newsvandal.com. I'll be on Ocelli tomorrow night, but newsvandal.com, get the newsletter. And congratulations on what is coming there at American University, John. Congratulations on the showing.
Oh, thank you so much. I'll have so much to tell you and the rest when we next meet, Joe. Thank you for the magnificent work that you do. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for supporting the film. And as Ed Murrow used to say, good night and good luck.
Sunny, 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 sunny. I love you.